you took your plans were secret when you left your office last night and you closed the door behind you. Were you walking in your sleep or were you just too tired to notice all the watchful eyes upon you? There's the man who does the maintenance and the maid who cleans the carpets in the hall. And the guard down in the lobby through a hidden TV camera saw it.
The Resistor. Terrible Tommy, Tom Metzger here in the bunker today. Yeah, on a beautiful day again. This is even going to be more beautiful than yesterday. But I want to tell you something. I don't play that song for just fun. I play The Resistor by Carl Klang because it contains almost every bit of information you need to operate as a lone wolf. Listen to it carefully. It's all there. Yeah. And if you're not listening and understanding, you better go back and start all over because all the elements of the lone wolf operation are in that song. Yeah. Well, it's P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's where you send your donations. And thank you for those who've got their donations for the radio show in already. That helps out a lot. And then go up to resist.com and educate yourself. Yeah, you can get a better than a Harvard education. Obama had a Harvard education. I don't know whether it did him much good or not, but he does seem to be a little brighter than the average mulatto. Okay, and also, let's see now, don't forget we're streaming the archive radio shows now, where you can go up there 24 hours a day and listen to the war radio, going back for years and years. And it is, did they get you this morning? April 1st, 2015, Wotan's Day, David Lane's favorite day. Yeah, I didn't pull one on my sweetie pie this morning. I gave her a little piece. Usually I pull a real good one, like, hey, honey, somebody ran into our car in front of the house, or the basement's flooded, the pump's not working, or toilets are all stopped up, or, you know, something real good. But I didn't get her this morning, and she didn't get me either. So, anyhow, pretty calm around here today. Except I finished up my mulching in my yard. Looks beautiful. Yeah. Did some work on my big 4x8 sign out front, my lit sign, and changed that to, discrimination is the positive force of evolution. It is, and including might is right and survival of the fittest. It's all there. And if you ever have to argue with somebody about it, just talk to them about the animal world. People who raise hybrid horses, professional race horses and people like that who raise show dogs or show animals for the county fair and all that, how they breed. And they sure don't breed down with obvious lesser animals. People are the same way. It's very simple. But since the Christians have tried to convince everybody, you're not an animal, you're a human being. Well, I think that if we didn't come from somewhere else, we're just way up there, high animals. We're the highest of the animal world. But we still have all the various things that an animal has in them, you know, survival and to kill and whatever you have to do. And so if you quit understanding that and get away from that, you can't figure anything out. But that's what these so-called progressives that are pretty regressive on the race issue need to know. Yeah, well, I got something in here, I think, from one of my friends on the West Coast here wanted to say something. Just a minute. Well, here's his message, and he says it emphatically. We're going to die. We're all going to die. I do not fucking know why, but we're all going to die. You can scream and shout about it, have your fucking doubt about it, but no one gives a fuck. We're all out of luck. A bullet in the head or dying in your bed. It's all the fucking same. We are equally lame, so put the blame on me and hang me from a tree. I don't give a shit if you get shot in a ditch because there's no more fucking space for the whole human race. We all need to digress from making all this fucking mess. Ebola and AIDS ain't quick enough these days to cull out the weak faggots and the freaks. It's an extension of your ego to have more greedy sons when you cannot afford one. So step up to the no noose, you silly fucking goose, and take your fucking medicine, or I'll punch you in the head again. That's an old friend of mine from the West Coast. He's pontificating there. He's in his late 40s now, and he's still surfing out there on the beach. Can you believe that? And he's in great shape. kickboxer and the whole bit. He hasn't kickboxed too much professionally lately, but he has done it. So anyhow, he lets you know what the hell's going on. And he used all those words that got your mouth washed out with soap when you were a kid. Did you ever get your mouth washed out with soap? I did. I guess it was. I remember one time when I was about 3 or 4 years old. I can remember quite a ways back. We lived across the street from a riding stable. And if you've ever been around a riding stable, at least in the old days, they were pretty foul-mouthed people. Boy, they didn't hold back when it came to cussing. So once in a while, I'd go on over there or sit on the grass across the street and hear them talking. And I come back. I remember one time I came back to my mother and started cussing a blue streak. She stuffed a bar of soap in my mouth for a couple of minutes. That does have a positive effect. It cleans your mouth out, too. Wouldn't it be nice if all these lying politicians and presidents and kings and you name it, corporation CEOs, every time they lied, there'd be a big block of soap be shoved in their mouth? Wouldn't that be nice? I'd like to do that. Have somebody standing right there, and every time you catch them lying, and the news media and all those prognosticators, stick a piece of soap in their mouth. Well, let's start off with one of the biggest warmongers of this country ever produced, Woodrow Wilson. Let's take a couple of minutes and see why.
If people have any doubt at all about the gravity of this, I recommend they think back to the Lusitania. The Lusitania was a British luxury liner, and I talk about it in my book, Harvey Wasserman's History of the U.S., which covers 1860 to 1920. And the American public really did not want the U.S. to go into World War I. It was very unpopular. But in 1915, the Germans sank a luxury liner. It was a British ship going from the U.S. from New York to London. It was carrying all these passengers, including 120 Americans. And at the time, Britain and Germany were at war with each other. And one of the rules of war was that you were allowed to sink ships that were carrying weapons. And that was just basically a rule of the game. So the Germans sunk the Lusitania, and they claimed that it was full of weapons. And the British said there were no weapons. And 120 Americans died. And Woodrow Wilson seized on this as a big, you know, thing for beating the Germans, and this tremendous racist outbreak came. Everybody hated the Germans except the German Americans and the radical labor movement, which smelled fishy to them, and they did not want, because they knew if we got into World War One that there would be tremendous repression and a great skewing of interest in the issues at home, which were economic democracy and control of the factories and redistribution of wealth, as opposed to going into a war. But Wilson, of course, used this, and the people got into the preparedness movement and started building weapons. And then in 1916, Wilson ran as a peace candidate. In 1917, he got us into the war.
It
was all based, a lot of it was based on the emotional response to the 120 Americans who died in the Lusitania. Well, earlier this decade, with all the advances in undersea technology, guess what happened? A submarine, a deep-sea submarine, got down to the Lusitania. Guess what they found on the Lusitania? Tons of weapons that were being shipped from the U.S. to Great Britain. The United States got involved in World War One on the basis of a complete lie, and it's indisputable. So, you know, when people ever say, well, I had one news person actually say that she just couldn't believe that people would be so cynical as to arrange a deal to keep hostages in Iran longer so that they could win an election. Well, it's happened. It's happened before.
So if you didn't know before, you know now. But now they have the proof. They went down there and found all the weapons. And every so-called popular president we've had has used these kind of tactics. Now in that one, Edward Bernays was employed to travel around the country having meetings all over the country promoting the war to try to get the Americans, or mostly the white people, to say, okay, let's go to war. So what I'm saying is every one of these presidents who got us into a war or jumped into a war, and all the kings and queens and all the and all the premiers and so forth do the same thing. They're warmongering bastards, and you can't trust them. They lie, they cheat. You know, look at all the lies of Ronald Reagan. Whoa. And then Bill Clinton, and then right on up the line. They're all liars. Don't base your opinion and your life on those people. In fact, they all should have been hung by the neck until dead, Obama included. Oh, that would be lynching. No, no. That would be world court time.
And the effects of RFRA are rippling across the Hoosier state, but how will it impact Fort Wayne's convention market? Here's 21 Live's Emily Dwyer to explain.
The Religious Freedom Restoration Act has dominated local and national headlines since Governor Pence officially signed the bill last week. The backlash has been fierce.
Perception is reality, and we have to deal with the perception now that Indiana has a discriminatory law.
In Indianapolis, Gen Con, the biggest gaming convention in the country, is under contract with the city until 2020, but officials say the new law has them considering leaving town in the future. It's a similar tune being sung here in Northeast Indiana.
I do know that it's impacting people's decisions on where they will come to Fort Wayne. That's negatively hurting our industry.
Don't Dan O'Connell, come. President of Visit Fort Wayne, says there are about six national conventions that are now reconsidering coming to Fort Wayne. Convention organizers say their members are questioning whether or not they'll be welcome at local businesses.
We're arming them with information about how open and willing we are to welcome their delegates back to our community.
It's a good thing, too, because the economic impact of those six conventions is huge.
The six conventions that are reconsidering coming to Fort Wayne's worth about $1.2 million. That's about 3,500 people, 2,500 room nights. It's also threatening about $90,000 in local taxes that they won't be living here, in the food and beverage and hotel tax and some of those things.
O'Connell says this is a serious problem because not only could the city miss out on millions of dollars, but the image of the city could be tarnished.
We've worked for 20-some-odd years in my career here to promote Fort Wayne, to champion it. It's a great destination, very hospitable. We've put millions of dollars into building a very good product in our convention center and in our Coliseum and in our attractions. It was pretty much threatened by the passage of this law.
Visit Fort Wayne says they haven't heard from any local businesses that plan on changing their practices because of the law. In Fort Wayne, Emily Dwyer, 21 Alive.
Actually, boys and girls, this is all to keep your mind off the wars all over the place in the Middle East and the corruption in not only the state houses but the federal government in Washington, D.C., and all the corruption in the Pentagon and everywhere else. Keep your mind on silly stuff like this, which I could care where any of these corporations come to Indiana to have their bashes so their CEOs can get drunk and call a prostitute up to the hotel and stuff like that. Who cares? Oh, well, the people that have limited brains care on both sides. Not only the homosexual lobby that are petrified that they're not going to be able to buy a cake at a cake shop. That's all bullshit. How many businessmen you know that would turn down an order if they can make money? And just like this man is saying, this official here in Indiana, it's the money, man. It's the money. We've got to have the money, man. We'll do anything. We'll go anywhere. We'll deny anybody. And for the money, man. Give me the money, man. Money, money, money. Well, I see that Lufthansa, the company that had the plane that their pilot decided to do a crash into the Alps, knew he had severe depression as far back as 2009. Oh, thank you, Lufthansa. Well, let's see about Ahab on the Potomac. Oh, you don't know who that is? Well, that's Abraham Lincoln. That's what a lot of the southern people called him, Ahab on the Potomac. I think I've got a book about it here someplace. It was Good Friday, April 14, 1865, when John Wilkes Booth made his way into the presidential box at Ford's Theater, forcibly propped the door shut behind him, and shot a bullet into the head of Abraham Lincoln. For many mourners, the timing had unusual significance. The Civil War, in which some 750,000 Americans had lost their lives, was coming to an end. Just think of that. And then the aftermath of that, I watched a cowboy film last night. These guys on the frontier, and the guy finally come home after being gone for years to find out that his three brothers fought for the Civil War and died at, forget the battle, and then this guy fought on the side of the Union. And so, I mean, this insanity of all this. And they had a big ranch and let it go to hell. People don't seem to look into the aftermath of these wars and all the social problems that it brings and all the split families and everything. It's not just going to the war and getting your ass blown off. It's how it affects your family and your community and everything else. And for it goes on forever. I mean, the animosity between a hell of a lot of Southern people and the North is just as hot today, almost, as it was then. Well, anyhow, that's not the point of this reading. Just weeks earlier, citing that the nation's trauma in his second inaugural address, Lincoln had suggested that this mighty scourge of war was a form of divine retribution visited on both North and South, unquote. Divine retribution, Christ, insanity again, for the offense of slavery, capitalist slavery. He ended with words of consolation and exhortation. With malice towards none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right as God gives us the right to see the right. Yeah. When did you talk to him, Abraham? Did he come into the Oval Office? Like George Bush said, he talked to God about going to Iraq. Yeah. Let us strive on to finish the work we're in to bind up the nation's wounds. Well, there shouldn't have been any wounds in the first place. It should have been worked out, and it could have been worked out. And when I find my Civil War book that I'm misplaced around here, we're going to go back into that. Lincoln's own suffering is evident as the nation was inscribed in his countenance of his two life masks. One had been a cast as he was beginning his campaign for presidency in 1860, and the other in February 1865, some 2 months before the end of the war. All presidents have that problem. You look at them when they go into office and look at them when they come out of office, and they look terrible when they come out of office. Obama's getting his hair turning white. He's getting all lines in his face. He's worn out, man. In the intervening years, his face had become emaciated. His eyes were gouging into his skull, and his skin was creased by age and sadness. Well, it should, for ordering the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people. He should. In fact, they should be struck dead for doing that stuff, and he was. This war is eating my life out, Lincoln once told a friend. Well, you shouldn't have started it. Yeah, he did start it because the South said they warned him if you try to resupply that fort down Sumter, we'll have a war. Well, the crazy thing about it is that and I read that to you before one time, that there was didn't need resupplied, and it was all bullshit just to start the war. Lincoln once told a friend, "I have a strong impression that I shall not live to see the end." Well, it doesn't sadden me a bit with any of these bastards. Then came the assassination. You can see an account of his death and autopsy by Lincoln's family physician in the book With Firmness in the Right, Lincoln and the Jews. How about that? A fine new exhibit at the New York Historical Society. The handwritten pages are blotched with brown stains, likely Lincoln's blood, since it was, well, either that or he might have been chewing tobacco, too. Since it was widely noted that the president had been shot on the day marking the crucifixion of Jesus, who never existed. The spilling of his blood became imbued with religious resonance. Yeah. Yeah, let's go on with this. Wait a minute, I got to do something here. Pause. In New York, Congressman James A. Garfield, to become in 1881 the second U.S. president assassinated, stated, quote, "It may be almost impious to say it, but it does seem that Lincoln's death parallels that of the Son of God. Thus say all tyrants." Unquote. Unfortunately, the Christian parallel also prompted some to indulge in the world's most ancient slander. The Chicago Tribune characterized the assassination as the most horrid crime ever committed on this globe since the wicked Jews, crucified the Savior, unquote. Of all the things Jews are guilty of, that was the one thing they weren't guilty of. They've been paying for it ever since. Also invoking Venerable Kennard's was Lincoln's successor, Vice President Andrew Johnson, who was a much better man than Lincoln. And if he'd have been president, he would have kept us out of the war. But to know why that is, you got to read more about Andrew Johnson. Excoriating Judah P. Benjamin, who had served as Attorney General, Secretary of War, and Secretary of State in the Confederacy, as a sneaking, Jewish, unconscionable traitor, unquote. And citing the Apostle John's account of the crucifixion, Johnson placed Benjamin in that tribe that parts the garments of our Savior, for his vesture cast lots. I guess they didn't like that old Jew. Judah P. Benjamin, who escaped after the war with quite a bit of gold, made it to England and lived very comfortably the rest of his life, while veterans of the Civil War were starving. So much for malice toward none, unquote, and perhaps for the sorry fate of Reconstruction under Johnson's presidency. But such comments, some of which are to be read at the exhibition, hey, I got it out, or in its more detailed companion volume, provide context and contrast, not substance. For not only are any such sentiments absent from Lincoln's own writings, but the relationship between Lincoln and the Jews was something else entirely. From the book With Firmness in the Right, is on view till June the 7th, after which it will travel to the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Museum in Springfield, Illinois. It is a perfect companion to the current exhibition at the Morgan Library Museum, Lincoln Speaks, The Words That Transformed a Nation and Killed 750,000 People. Curated by Ann Meyerson and Dina Grossman, with Harold Holzer as historical advisor, an historical society exhibition is accompanied by the valuable recently released Lincoln and the Jews, a history, co-authored by the distinguished historian Jonathan D. Sarna of Brandeis, Jew, and by Benjamin Chappelle, president of the Manuscript Foundation, that owns many of the striking documents on display. You ever notice how the Jews sort of miraculously fall into owning great documents, you know, like the three Mein Kampfs that were just sold, I think, in Chicago for, I don't know, $20,000-$30,000 a piece in the hands of a Jew. They have a way of doing this. Yeah. And they feel no conscience about it. For American Jews, Lincoln's death was associated not with Good Friday, but with the simultaneous holiday of Passover, and not with Jesus, but with Moses, who had liberated his people from slavery, but was unable to lead them into the Promised Land. Well, he didn't liberate them from slavery in Egypt at all. That's bullshit. Even Israeli researchers have poo-pooed most of this. In fact, I would say Moses never existed. He was a remake of the god Mises out of Babylon, and before that, the god Nabu from before. These were fake gods. They weren't people. Okay. Many learned of Lincoln's death on Saturday morning while on their way to Sabbath services. Adolphus S. Solomons, an Orthodox printer and bookseller in Washington, D.C., who had managed Lincoln's inaugural ball in 1861, noted that it was the Israelites' privilege here, as well as elsewhere, to be the first to offer their place of worship, prayers for the repose of the soul of Mr. Lincoln. Well, that soul, I think, if it was going anywhere, would be going down into Hades, as all warmongering leaders. At Temple Emmanuel in New York, the congregation rose as one at the news and recited in unison the Kaddish memorial prayer. Rabbi Elkin Cohen of San Francisco's Emmanuel, hearing the news as he mounted the pulpit to deliver his sermon, was so overcome, unquote, reads one report, that bursting in tears, he sank almost senseless, unquote. Well, isn't that nice? Christians and non-Christians are always falling for the Jewish bullshit. The exhibition offers a sampling of synagogue eulogies. Quote, we should regard Abraham Lincoln, unquote, said Rabbi Benjamin Zold of Baltimore, as a son of Israel. Yeah. Another eulogist was Louis Naftali Dembitz of Louisville, uncle of the future Supreme Court Justice Louis Dembitz Brandeis, and a Republican leader so devoted to Lincoln's political creed that he named one son after Henry Clay, the young Lincoln's political idol, and another after Lincoln himself. Rabbi Isaac M. Wise of Cincinnati, who had initially jeered at Lincoln's election, quote, one of the greatest blunders a nation can commit, unquote, only to become an ardent admirer, the greatest man that ever sprung from mortal loins, unquote, claimed that Lincoln had once confided to him that he was bone from our bone, flesh from our flesh, unquote. Oh, Lincoln declared he was a Jew and supposed himself a descendant of Hebrew parentage. Well, you know, there's people who have accused Lincoln of being, a knockoff part of the race that had Negro blood. I forget the name of those people, but there's a sizable number of them in the country, and were in the country at that time. You do notice in looking at Lincoln, he had a dark, a little darker complexion. So anyhow, if I read about that racial split off, I'll tell you about it. I don't have a note here about it, but there were serious accusations along those lines. Since there's no other evidence supporting such a statement, Lincoln might have been speaking metaphorically, and maybe not. But his ancestors, as the exhibition points out, included New England Calvinists, who bore names straight out of the Hebrew Bible, as the Puritans tended to emphasize Hebrew scripture in general, alluded to their settling in the New World as a sign of the restoration of Israel, and in some cases even imagined Hebrew as a future American language. Some aspect of their feelings of kinship may have passed down through generations. Although Lincoln himself famously belonged to no church, he quoted the Hebrew Bible, the exhibition records, about three times as often as he did the New Testament, and the rhythms of the King James Version run throughout his speeches, his writings, and it seems his conversation. Well, if you'll listen to these TV preachers, you'll find the same thing. Many times they spend all their sermons on the Old Testament, the Torah, which makes them pseudo-Jews as far as I'm concerned. In other words, that's once you know that two-thirds of the Bible is nothing but the Jew Torah, you'll know that Christianity is no good for the white race. Actually, it's no good for, it's even worse for the black race. They're the biggest fools of all. In brief, he was no casual acquaintance, and if the living Jews of the time felt an unusual connection with Lincoln, it is no less clear than the letters, official papers, personal notes, and artifacts gathered here that he seemed to feel similar connection. Now remember, there were guys, Jews in the armor business, guns and so forth, and all kinds of stuff. They were very, very heavily into that, and especially up there in New York. And so, of course, a big war made them a fortune. And, of course, they're not going to admit that they loved him because of that. One that contrasts starkly with the regnant attitudes of his time. This association, not often examined, may also reveal something about Lincoln's vision of the world. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. Some of the items on display may not seem to offer much, being rather of the kind intended to inspire ethnic and religious pride. Did you? You see, they don't use race anymore. It's all ethnic. Did you know that the designer of the 1909 Lincoln penny was a Jew? Well, I'm not surprised at all. Or the 19-year-old telegraph operator at the White House who broadcast the Emancipation Proclamation, or the bearded doctor who was among the attended physicians at Lincoln's deathbed and who appeared directly above the president in Alonzo Chapel's famous 1867 painting, The Last Hours of Abraham Lincoln. On the first man to take a photograph of Lincoln in 1858 and loaned him his own velvet trimmed coat for the occasion? Well, that's why the United States will never maintain and last as a big power. It was screwed from the beginning. The rot was in. Jewish Christianity was the rot. And it's been rotting us ever since. So this experiment for the white race is over. It is over. It's been over since the very beginning. Just through the wars and occupation of people, it's been able to have enough money to keep going. But that time is running out, and the people in these other countries are getting pissed. I mean, really pissed. These examples reveal less about Lincoln's relationship with the Jews than about how, in the mid-19th century, Jewish immigrants were already making their way into the wider society. In 1809, the year Lincoln was born, there were perhaps 3,000 Jews in the United States. No, but there were millions of pseudo-Jews through Christianity that might as well have been Jews. In fact, I say they are Jews, since anybody can be a Jew. All you have to do is swear your allegiance to their bullshit. By 1840, the number had risen to about 15,000. But by 1860, thanks to extensive immigration from mostly Germanic lands, and guess what that was about? The war, the revolution of 1853, I think it was, in Germany and around. Guess who was involved in stoking that? The Jews and the Jew bankers. So from the revolution, failed revolution, came all these Jews that were involved in the revolution streaming across to guess what? Fill the ranks here of the bureaucrats and so forth. The arms makers getting ready for the Civil War. I think all this shit is linked myself. The figure had leaped upward to 150,000 Jews now. One part of a much larger wave that brought over 3 million immigrants to American shores. Quote, wherever there is a chance for profitable trade, unquote, the New York Journal of Commerce intoned, Jews have insinuated themselves. Oh! Just like Karl Marx said, the Jews are, all they care about, the main thing they care about is money. And then they cloak all this money grabbing under this crazy-ass religion. Lincoln's first contact with Jews in the persons of store owners in Kentucky and Illinois may have been due to such insinuations, but his most important Jewish connection was with a fellow lawyer, Abraham Jonas, who was born in England and had come to the United States in 1819. Jonas' law practice in Quincy, Illinois, was in the same building as the congregation B'nai Abraham, which his family had helped establish. The two lawyers became political allies, fellow admirers of Henry Clay, both campaigned for the Whig Party, were elected to the state legislature, and became active in the anti-slavery Republican Party after its founding in 1854. Jonas, apparently no mean politician himself, championed Lincoln, helped organize his debates with Stephen A. Douglas, and worked to propel him into the presidency in 1860. Once in office, Lincoln, who called Jonas, quote, one of my most valued friends, that's like Willis Carto and what's his name, wrote the book about Oswald and the assassination, Mark Lane, when he stood before the court in California, Vista, California court, and I was sitting there in the audience when he gets Mark Lane up there beside him, a real Jew, I'll tell you, looked like Wolfman, and proclaimed that Mark Lane is perhaps my best friend, or my best friend, and I about passed out. Anyhow, we'll go on from there. Anyhow, once in office, Lincoln, who called Jonas one of my most valued friends, made him a postmaster, a patronage position in Quincy, and after Jonas' death, appointed his widow to the position lest the family be left without income. Well, let's go on here. The Historical Society exhibition, I got it out again, gives considerable attention to the friendship which even extended to Jonas's children, five who moved to the South and two whom joined the rebel army. Well, that's interesting. That reminds me of Lord Balfour in England, who put together the Balfour Declaration to promoting the idea of giving the Jews Palestine. And his son John went and fought on the side of Hitler in World War II and was brought back to England after the war and hung. Payback to Balfour, I guess. Yet Lincoln's interaction with them remained touching and compassionate throughout. One of them, a lawyer, contacted Lincoln. I don't think he was that compassionate to the Confederate soldiers that were dying of starvation and everything else in the concentration camps of the Federals. And, to be honest, it was the same way on the other side, the concentration camps of the Confederacy. One of them, a lawyer, contacted Lincoln in 1857 on behalf of a black man from Illinois imprisoned in New Orleans for lack of papers. Lincoln raised the money to rescue him. During the Civil War, as Abraham Jonas lay ill, President Lincoln arranged to give another son, a Confederate prisoner of war, a 3-week parole to visit his dying father. See, he didn't do that to white so-called Christians, Confederates, POWs, did he? But he did that Jew boy, huh? What do you think? The Jonas example is not the only personal relationship that stands out in Lincoln's association with Jews. Among his more colorful acquaintances was a chiropodist named Issachar Zachariah, who earned a testimonial letter for alleviating the pain in the president's feet. Evidently a bit of an operator, Zachary gained Lincoln's trust. That reminds me of the doctor that was next to Hitler and got him hooked on meth. What's his name? Well, anyhow, I've told you many times. Becoming emissary to New Orleans to imbue his countrymen with loyalty to the Union, he also acted as a kind of spy, reporting on Confederate troop movements. His correspondence with the president extended over a period of 2.5 years with multiple White House meetings. But the close connection felt by many Jews to Lincoln was not, of course, based on personal acquaintance. As the exhibition notes, Lincoln's position on slavery, together with his ardent advocacy of American possibility, must have resonated deeply with the growing Jewish population. Well, one thing you got to know why Jews are always into this kind of stuff is because they believe their own propaganda. I mean, their common Jews believe their own propaganda. Plus the fact they want no borders, no immigration control. They want to be able to move their tribe around the world and their money-making schemes without any hindrance. That's why so many Jews support open borders. Why else would a Chicago merchant named Abraham Cohn have thought to send the newly elected president a painting of an American flag in whose white stripes was inscribed in Hebrew, a passage from the book of Joshua, "Be strong and be of good courage, be not afraid, neither be thou dismayed, for the Lord thy God is with thee wherever thou go." It was indeed a special moment in American Jewish history. Not only were Jewish immigrants becoming established themselves, but they were raising children who were entering the American society. And then there was the effect of the war. Passages Through the Fire, Jews in the Civil War. That's a book. A compelling exhibition 2 years ago at Yeshiva University Museum, co-presented by the American Jewish Historical Society, suggested that the war served as a crucible for American Jewish life. Through its trials on both sides of the conflict, Jews were inducted into the mainstream of America, a change reflected in politics as well as in everyday commerce. This is another method of screwing your race up. And after they broke down the racial barriers in the military, that then you had blacks in World War I, you had blacks in World War II. And you've had blacks ever since. Now you got black generals and everything else. And you've got spreading this blackness all over the world. Occupation armies are filled with blacks, filled with mestizos and other things, but mainly blacks and what they do in Germany. I was there. I saw what blacks were doing in Germany. They would pay any amount of money to get a white woman and screw her. I mean, there was a section of the whites in Germany, the women, that only wanted to go to black bars because they could get a lot more money from the black guys than from the whites. So this idea of war and armies could move along mixing of the races. And it's one of the worst causes of the mixing of the races. The military bases in the United States and other countries are in the forefront of race mixing. Always have been for a long time, since a lot of the old school got out. Okay. Okay, I got some more here. Just stand by. You want a story about the Civil War, I'm giving it to you. I'm giving it to you about the Jews, too. So at home in America, were Jews beginning to feel that at least one Union soldier from Ohio could joyfully recount in 1862 a Passover Seder held by 20 of my comrades and co-religionists belonged to the regiment, unquote. His account can be heard on the exhibition's audio tour. After vividly describing the elaborate preparations, the menu, and the drinking, quote, "We forgot the law authorizing us to drink only 4 cups, and the consequences was we drank up all the cider," unquote. He concludes, "There in the wild woods of West Virginia, away from home and friends, we consecrated and offered up an ever-loving God of Israel our prayers and sacrifice. I doubt whether the spirits of our forefathers, had they been looking down on us, standing there with our arms by our sides, ready for an attack, faithful to our God and our cause, would have imagined themselves among mortals." Well, they all thinking themselves as gods. Well, that's what the Jew God is. They create their God. That's what all religions do. They create their God. And he acts like he does and says how they act. I mean, you know, it's a crazy thing, you know. You're going to create a God who thinks like you do. But the Jews have a problem because they have this guilt thing they carry around all the time about everything. And so they even have their own God that they created rebuke them. "I'm banishing you bastards. Wait a minute, we created you." Jews entering American life and confronting, no doubt, many obstacles along the way, yeah, like people who didn't want to be screwed out of everything they had, must have felt a strong connection with a president who stood out for non-erected barriers, indeed for extending a welcome, "come on in." During the war, roster of Lincoln's Jewish appointments is astonishing. In addition to Jonas, Henry Rice, a dry goods merchant from Lincoln knew from Springfield, was endorsed by him to become a sutler or military storekeeper. C.M. Levy, an Orthodox Jew from New York who had applied for a quartermaster position responsible for army housing, transport, clothing, and supplies, earned his 1862 approbation addressed by Lincoln to his Secretary of War, Edward Stanton. Quote, "We have not yet appointed a Hebrew," unquote. And Levy is a capable and faithful man. About 50 other Jews would likewise serve as quartermasters for the Union. In addition, although Congress had ruled that chaplains in the Army had to be ordained ministers of a Christian denomination, Lincoln responded positively to the direct appeal of a Jewish candidate for such a position. And in July 1862, the chaplaincy was opened to non-Christians for the first time. You know, Christians are trying to, now they're saying that, the Muslims, they're going to make Muslims speak before the Congress and say prayers, and they're going to do this, they're going to do that. Hell, this has been going on for a long time. It's just a new bunch of liars. A new bunch of fanatics. Okay, let's see here. But they'll always, if these people bring money and serve the federal government, they're always going to let them in to whatever. Lincoln also promoted Jewish officers in the Union Army. In fact, hardly worth noting unless one knew that, as an exhibition points out, quote, "In the military, anti-Semitism was casual, yet virulent and omnipresent." How can it be casual and virulent? Union generals seem to endorse it as policy. Maybe that is why we see Lincoln on multiple occasions overriding unjustified condemnations or convictions of Jews. In early 1865, he intervened on behalf of two Jewish clothiers, Philip and Meyer Wallach, who we read were, quote, unjustly convicted of selling contraband goods to the Confederacy, unquote. But he also let stand a conviction, if he found it just, a replica of a drawing here shows a procession of five deserters being led to their execution in Virginia in 1863, and one of them is a Jew with a rabbi at his side. Another thing you got to understand, the Jews merchants in the North were dealing all through the war with Southern cotton, you know, as far as being patriotic to the North. They were sneaking cotton by the millions of pounds across the war lines and into the North. So anyhow, that's the way a lot of the Jews made a fortune, running the blockade. The most notorious example of official anti-Semitism or anti-Jewism during the war was, of course, Ulysses S. Grant. December 17, 1862, ordered expelling Jews as a class from the territory he controlled. Grant was attempting to combat cotton smugglers, of which I just mentioned, and had decided that Jews were the villains. One Union soldier in a letter here testifies to having observed cotton smuggling, but not by Jews. Quote, we soldiers can't understand why they're singling them out. Unquote. Don't understand that. Others appealed directly to Lincoln, who had not been aware of the order. He said, I do not like to hear a class or nationality condemned on account of a few sinners. The order was rescinded. Well, Grant wasn't anti-Jewish. Grant was, as a younger officer, lived in Mississippi. And he had many Jewish friends. You can look it up. I've got the books in my library. And then he was transferred to San Francisco, where he really got in with the merchant Jewish class in San Francisco. So, and that was long before the war. Okay. You can't get into high power position in this country or any other country without kissing the Jews' ass. You just can't do it. Or you have to be totally quiet and say they're wonderful all the time. But if you let your feelings out, and if you try to act on your feelings, you're screwed. I guess Uncle Adolf realized that too. Lincoln's record in all this is stunning, unlike that of any American president until the 20th century. While little of the information of the exhibition seems new, and the subject has even inspired previous books, including one as early as 1909 by Isaac Markins, and while the exhibition would have benefited from greater narrative continuity, the overall effect is powerful, strong enough to place Lincoln in a new light. Abraham Lincoln was a philo-Semite, a philo-Jew. Now, this is written by a Jew. I didn't tell you that, did I? This is written by a Jew. But what was the source of this sentiment? There is, as we said, his family history to consider, his religious heritage, which was mostly Jewish in the Old Testament, which may have made him less likely to indulge in calumny. Well, the war was calumny. But given his contracts and friendships, he also had to have developed a fairly sophisticated understanding of Jewish beliefs and even of Jewish history. The exhibition points out that his sympathies may have also been stirred by the Jewish-themed plays that the Lincolns attended in 1864 and 1865, including Shakespeare's The Merchant of Venice. Twice he attended Gamia, or The Jewish Mother. About 1859, abduction and secret baptism of a Jewish child in Italy on order of the Pope. And he also saw Leah, the Forsaken, a play about an 18th century Austrian anti-Semitism that the editor of Harper's Weekly believed was relevant to the war, then being raged over a similar outcast race. But these were late experiences and could only have confirmed and deepened his pro-Jewish position. One important reason for the affinity emphasized in both the exhibition of the book was Lincoln's interpretation of the National Project, his vision of equality. See, there you go, a true demagogue who believes in equality. He don't believe in equality. No demagogue believes in equality. It is, there's no way, it's against the rules. His treatment of Jews as fellow citizens seems in this reading to be a corollary to his convictions about slavery, objecting to restrictions on immigration in 1855, for example. He wrote, "I have some little notoriety for the commensurating with the oppressed condition of the Negro." And, of course, Lincoln talked out of both sides of his mouth all the time. "And I should be strangely inconsistent if I could favor curtailing the existing rights of white men, even though born in different lands and speaking different language from myself." This is the opening quotation of the Historical Society's exhibition, which throughout underlines Lincoln's striving for tolerance and inclusivity. The theme surely had something to do with the affinity, but it is too broad to yield insight into the case specifically of the Jews. Was it perhaps that Lincoln felt the Jews in particular shared his vision? There is certainly a tendency today to associate Jewish identity itself with a belief in tolerance and inclusivity. Tell that to the Palestinians. But the behavior of Jews during the Civil War was more equivocal. Of the 10,000 Jews who fought, 3,000 served in the Confederate Army. As Lincoln had to know, moreover, there were rabbis who opposed abolition. Some, to their latter embarrassment, Rabbi Morris Raphael of New York's B'nai Yeshurun Synagogue, for example, supported Douglas over Lincoln and adduced biblical justifications for slavery. In a discomforting passage in their book, Sarna and Chappelle mentioned that, according to some sources, the family of John Wilkes Booth was itself of Jewish extraction. You see how everything is all mixed up and screwed up when you get into this religious swamp? So are we making too much of this matter of a specific affinity? In a recent collection, R. Lincoln, New Perspectives, edited by Eric Foner, the historian Robert Coverdine, writes that Lincoln strove to maintain good relations with all faiths and met with a full gamut of religious visitors. Coverdine also suggests, without mentioning Jews, that many religious groups claimed Lincoln for their own. Quakers pointed to his Virginia ancestors, Baptists to his parents' faith, Episcopalians to his wedding ceremony, Presbyterians to the ministry he heard, spiritualists to seances at the White House in which Mary Todd Lincoln tried to contact the spirit of her dead son. That reminds me of Mrs. Reagan and her and Ronald Reagan and their Methodists, Unitarians, Universalists, and Catholics, not to mention Freemasons, have found or invented reasons to clasp into their bosoms. Oh yeah, Ronald Reagan and his wife were into astrology, so was Hitler. It might tell you why there's a lot of screw-ups by those people. Is the Jewish case just another example, then, of Lincoln's wide embrace? I don't think so, but makes it so peculiar when compared with these other examples is that Lincoln's attitudes towards Jews was so dramatically at odds with mainstream American opinion at the time. So he was not representing America on the Jewish issue. This suggests an intellectual consanguinity, even an aspect of shared belief. Recall Lincoln's intimate affection for the Hebrew Bible. Mary Todd Lincoln told friends that Lincoln said he wanted to see Jerusalem before he died. In the exhibition, we are greeted in the final gallery by Frederick Edwin Church's luminous, immense Jerusalem from the Mount Mount of Olives, painted in 1870, the city, quote, as Lincoln might have seen had he lived. If Lincoln did not share with the Jews a particular religious temperament, in what did it consist? This is difficult to specify because his approach to religion tended to be solitary and ruminative and shifted over the years. Aside from his reading in the Bible, he regularly met with the White House, as Carradine reports, with preachers and ministers of various sects, including one self-proclaimed prophet and Christian messianist who Lincoln announced, quote, I myself have a regard for the Jews, unquote. All seemed to agree that he was deeply a religious man, in other words, half nuts. In fact, he established more holidays for national religious observance, including the first nationwide Thanksgiving, than any president before him. As the end of the Civil War approached, he evidently devoted much of his to the conflict of religious significance. Got to have some excuse. The subject, in a sense, of the second inaugural, saturated as it was with allusions to both Hebrew scripture and the New Testament. Wow. Wow. Just got a few paragraphs left, but I'm going to go ahead and read it. If Lincoln did share with the Jews a particular religious wait a minute. Let's see here. Okay. I missed the paragraph. Such generalities aside, some fundamental aspects of Lincoln's thought are notably consistent with a particular Jewish orientation. When Lincoln speaks of God and the role of God plays in the world, he devotes almost no attention to the idea of salvation or other worldly reward. For him, our interactions with God are this worldly. While he made varying endorsements of predestination, his emphasis was on the ways we choose to regulate our lives and on the principles we choose to affirm. This had something to do with his stubborn attachment to the law, a salient element of his approach to slavery that was at odds with the position of radical abolitionists. Agreeing with the latter's moral ideals, he never argued that any alteration to the system had to follow the law meticulously. There were political considerations behind his stance, needless to say, but it was his adherence to law that accounted for a limited scope of Emancipation Proclamation, which freed only the slaves in the rebelling states. Lincoln's belief was that he could not, as a president, simply eliminate slavery. That was left to Congress in the 13th Amendment. But as commander-in-chief in the midst of the war, he did have some control over rebel property. He also had the authority to act to suppress the rebellion. That was freeing the slaves in the rebellious states would do, and why the proclamation was issued in the president's name, quote, by virtue of the power vested in me as commander-in-chief. That's like Obama's doing today, executive orders. It calls itself all presidents use executive orders. It calls itself a fit and necessary war measure. The point of this fastidiousness was to emphasize his main principle. Fidelity to law was essential. In fact, it was the issue of the stake in the Civil War itself. Secession was an act of legal violation. As he suggested at the Gettysburg Address, Lincoln wished to demonstrate that it was possible, while clinging strictly to laws founded on the principles of equality and democratic governance, for a nation so conceived and so dedicated to long endure, and not just to endure, but to usher in a new birth of freedom. Well, that's bullshit, because this country has never been a democracy, and most of the time didn't adhere to any kind of democratic principles at all. In the back room, things were done differently. Read the book, let's see, what was that? Well, I forget. In the same address, he speaks in high religious tones while insisting that the unfinished work and the great task remaining are the responsibilities of us, the living, fulfilling the... Oh, cracks in the Constitution. You need to read cracks in the Constitution. It's not going to you're not going to agree with everything it says, but it's all there as far as not being a democracy. Fulfilling that responsibility, however, would not yield to a perfect world, when in the Dred Scott decision of 1857, the Supreme Court suggested that the Declaration of Independence had not extended equality to Negroes. Remember, there were people back there that wanted to equalize marriage to Negroes, too. They wanted to go all the way. Lincoln retorted that the Declaration was meant to be a standard maximum for a free society, regardless of society's failings at the time, and that it should serve as a guide, constantly looked to, constantly labored for, and even though never perfectly attained, constantly approximated. The world would always fall short, but it would be up to the people to labor for the ideal's achievement. Bullshit, the people don't have hardly any say. Never did. Except being stupid and doing something wrong, voting the wrong way. Some of the same spirit appears in the second inaugural, which speaks of the firmness in the right as God gives us to see the right. The conviction of being right is a human conviction, therefore necessarily incomplete. Well, that's for sure. Both sides think they're right in any controversy. Lincoln is convinced, as he says, quoting Psalms 19, that the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether, unquote. But he knows human efforts are unending. I am using broad strokes here, but it strikes to me that this set of emphasis on this worldly activity, on law as the basis and necessary means of human action, on human incompleteness, in another context, on education as an instrument of freedom, well, we've seen how far that works. Jefferson believed once everybody had an education, everybody would do right. Well, that sure didn't work out. Are congruent with the bedrock Jewish ideas and values, and in their own way helped explain the close connections between Lincoln and the Jews. So at any rate, it was believed at the time, Louis Naftali Dembitz, in his eulogy at the Addis Jerum congregation in Louisville, Kentucky, had it partly right, quote, "Of all the Israelites throughout the United States, there is none who more thoroughly fill the ideal of what a true descendant of Abraham ought to be than Abraham Lincoln." And you boys, these southern guys, don't get all excited because you made the same mistake down south. At least the north didn't have a bar mitzvah Jew in their government like you did, in a powerful position, Judah P. Benjamin. You need to read about him. I've got a big book on him. I haven't read it all. But he was an interesting character. That's it for today. I'll be back tomorrow on Thursday. And we'll go at it again. Comment on this. Yeah, I like your comments. But I don't get a lot of comments. I feel lonely, like the lonely Linwood Ford man out in California. Okay, bye-bye.